Imagine being able to feel a tiny speck, just 50 nanometers high. I mean, just because of the patterns on your fingertips, it's amazing how sensitive touch can be.
It really is.
Or think about this. The reality you experience, not really a perfect snapshot, is it? More like your brain's best guess, optimized to keep you safe.
That's a great way to put it. It's about survival, not necessarily objective reality.
Okay, let's dive into this. Today on The Deep Dives, we're exploring the world of sensory receptors, all based on the fantastic material you sent in.
Yes, and we've got quite a collection here, covering everything from touch to sight, smell, the whole range.
Exactly. What's truly remarkable, and this comes from the senses, a comprehensive reference, is that our senses aren't just passive data collectors.
Right. They evolve for action, basically. Avoiding danger, finding mates, getting things done efficiently. Objective truth. Often secondary.
Secondary to survival, both for us as individuals and, well, for the species.
Precisely.
So our mission today, to get a much deeper understanding of how we actually perceive the world, it's way more intricate than just the basic five senses.
Absolutely. We'll explore why we have the senses we do.
You'll do it with the depth you expect, but, you know, efficiently.
Yeah.
Trying to leave you feeling genuinely enlightened by the end.
Sounds good. And stepping back, looking at the bigger picture, it's clear our senses, the reality they build, it's all tied to our specific environment, our ecological niche.
Like a dolphin using sonar. That's a completely different reality from, say, a cat using smell and night vision.
Exactly. Or a snake detecting infrared. Our human experience, mostly sight and sound, it's just one version, not the definitive one.
It's so easy to think we humans see and feel, well, everything important.
Uh-huh. But perception is constant interpretation. The brain filters, prioritizes what's key for survival.
Yeah, I love that quote from the Mountain Woman. You believe as much as you see, and you see as much as you believe. It really captures that interplay, doesn't it?
It does. And that leads to a crucial point about what we perceive. Things like color, pitch, taste, smell.
They aren't just out there in the waves.
Not exactly. They're percepts, mental constructions, created by neuron activity. Fundamentally, they exist in our minds.
Like purely internal things, too. Appreciating beauty, feelings, imagining a unicorn.
Precisely. All products of neural activity. And this isn't just for complex animals.
Right. Even basic sensory receptors co-evolved with environments. That's why there's such diversity in the animal and plant kingdoms.
You see simple perception even in single-celled organisms and plants. Ledoux and Balika talk about this. Simple chemical processes, membrane channels.
Leading to things like taxes, movement towards or away from chemicals.
Yes, chemotaxis. Mm-hmm. And in more complex organisms, you get nasties, localized movements. Think of a Venus flytrap snapping shut.
Haptonasty, right. Triggered by touch, but also chemical signals to know if it's actually food.
Exactly. And these chemical senses aren't just for food. Pheromones for finding mates. Even our own gametes use similar taxes.
It connects to things like our immune cells, too, doesn't it? Leukocytes finding invaders using chemical trails.
It does. And bacteria responding to sugars or toxins. Then you have other taxes, phototaxis for light, thermotaxis for heat.
Magnetotaxis, electrotaxis, geotaxis for gravity.
The whole range. And in plants, you see tropisms, directional growth.
Like a sunflower following the sun, heliotropism, or roots growing down, geotropism, and towards water, hydrotropism.
These are fundamental mechanisms, cellular reactions driving organism-level responses.
And the communication between plants, using chemicals to warn each other about pests.
Fascinating stuff. Some even call it plant neurophysiology. The signaling, the receptors, they show remarkable similarities to animals. Sensing and responding is just fundamental to life.
It's wild how much energy all this takes. The brain uses, what, 20% of our energy?
Yeah, at least. But the nerve endings themselves are huge consumers too, constantly making ATP, that cellular energy currency, just for synapses to work.
Packing those vesicles with neurotransmitters.
Right. And even at rest, there's proton leakage from vesicles. The proton pump needed to counteract that uses almost half the brain's total energy.
Wow. Just to be ready to perceive.
Exactly. So much microscopic work.
Okay. So moving from the receptors to the neurons they connect to, evolution didn't just give us diverse receptors.
No, it also gave us incredibly complex neuron networks. These networks extract the useful information needed for decisions, for reactions.
Like a camera lens focuses light, but the processor inside analyzes it.
Good analogy. And that processing starts right away, locally, with different neuron types.
How do these neurons get activated?
Two main ways. Either by the flow of ions, charged particles, across their membranes.
Or by chemical molecules binding to them. Ligands.
Precisely. Odor molecules, taste molecules, hormones, neurotransmitters, they act like keys fitting into receptor protein locks.
And when enough positive ions flow in, that's when a neuron fires.
That's the action potential. Sodium ions in, potassium ions out. If it reaches a threshold, boom. Chain reaction down the nerve fiber.
Got it. Okay, let's get into specific senses, starting with touch and proprioception. It's amazing that touch is the first sense working in the womb.
It really underscores how fundamental it is. You can be born without sight or hearing, but lacking touch entirely is almost unheard of.
So how do we categorize these signals?
Well, first you have external sensation. That includes extraoceptive surface stuff like touch, vibration, pain, temperature, taste.
And teleceptive, the distant senses, vision and hearing.
Right. Then proprioceptive, the inner sense from muscles, joints, tendons, the inner ear for balance, body state and position.
And finally, interoceptive from internal organs.
Yes. Visceral sensation, signals from inside like organs, blood vessels.
And there's a difference in precision.
Generally, yes. The deeper visceral stuff, protopathic, is often less precise, integrated lower down in the brainstem and subcortical areas.
Well, the surface and the distant senses, epicritic, allow for finer discrimination analyzed up in the cortex.
Exactly. And the skin itself, our largest sensory organ, is incredible. Up to 2 square meters, varying thickness, multiple layers.
With nerve cells, immune cells, glands, hair, nails, it's a barrier, a protector, allows selective exchange. Multifunctional.
And packed with somatosensory receptors, nerve endings, dendrites, embedded right in the tissue, responding to pressure, tension, highly specialized.
Some for gentle stroking, others for touch, vibration, temperature. You said at least 6 types for temperature alone.
At least 6 thermoreceptors, yeah. Plus receptors in muscles and tendons telling us about body position and movement. That's proprioception again.
Okay, let's focus on touch, heat, pain. What are the basic touch receptors in human skin?
Well, there are 5 main types usually highlighted. First, Ruffini corpuscles. Deep and hairless skin, slow adapting, sensitive to stretch.
Then Pacinian corpuscles. Deep layers too. Fingers, tendons.
Right. They adapt very fast. Great for detecting initial contacts, sudden pressure changes, vibrations.
And Meissner's corpuscles. Hands, lips.
Yes. Sensitive to vibrations up to about 50 hertz. Also, fast adapting why we stop feeling our clothes. The vibration mechanically opens and closes ion channels.
Next are Merkel cells.
Merkel cells. They give detailed info on pressure, texture, slow adapting, most sensitive at lower frequencies, 5-15 hertz, sustained contact.
And finally, free nerve endings.
The simplest, no special structure. They signal pain nociceptors, but also basic touch, pressure, stretch, temperature, variable adaptation speeds.
And signal speed varies hugely too, right?
Yeah.
From slow temperature signals to super fast touch signals.
Exactly. Thin, unmyelinated C fibers for temperature, maybe 1 meter per second. Thick, myelinated A alpha fibers for some touch proprioception, up to 120 meters per second. That's why touch feels instant, but a dull ache takes longer.
Looking beyond humans, insects sensing air movement with hairs.
Incredible sensitivity. Helps them detect size, distance, trigger escapes, even locate sound sources, touch blending into hearing there.
And the star-nosed mole, using those Eimer's organs on its snout.
Moving them maybe 12 times a second, packed with receptors, stimulating 100,000 nerve fibers. It's basically building a tactile image to find worms, seeing with its nose.
Amazing adaptations. So for us, touch helps identify objects, but also proprioception gives us our body image, somatognosia.
Constant monitoring of body position, knowing where your limbs are without looking.
And our sensitivity is just incredible. Feeling that 50 nanometer bump because of fingerprints, perceiving temperature changes of 0.01 degrees Celsius.
It highlights the precision, which leads us to psychophysics, studying the link between physical stimuli and subjective experience.
The Weber-Fechner law.
Exactly. Started in the 19th century. Basically, our sensation intensity relates logarithmically to the stimulus intensity change relative to the starting intensity. The stronger the start, the bigger the change needed to notice it.
Makes sense. Okay, let's move to smell. Many animals rely hugely on smell and touch, right? Like nudibranchs.
Absolutely. Those sea slugs are often blind, but thrive with amazing smell. Shows you don't need advanced senses for success. Smell is vital for finding food mates.
And olfactory mapping. Marking territory.
Definitely. Scent marks convey a lot of information.
And how do the receptors work? It's not one receptor per smell.
No, it's combinatorial coding. We have maybe 1,000 receptor types across animals, but each odor hits multiple receptors, and each receptor responds to many odors, like letters forming words.
That was the Buck and Axel Nobel Prize discovery, right? Around 1999, 2004.
That's the one. And this system lets humans distinguish, what, maybe 10,000 different smells?
Wow. And some people, like in the perfume industry, have incredibly refined smell. fMRI even shows olfactory cortex activity just imagining smells.
With training, yes. It can even lead to a slightly thicker cortex in that area. The brain adapts.
But we all have some difficulty naming smells, right? Olfactory anosmia.
We do. We recognize far more than we can name. Though in some cultures, like the Jahat people in Malaysia, smell naming is highly developed, almost like naming colors for us. Their lifestyle demands it.
And damage there can cause olfactory hallucinations, maybe linked to epilepsy.
It can be a symptom, yes. And interestingly, taste receptors are structurally very similar. Olfactory receptors also fade quickly. You need active sniffing to keep stimulating them.
How are the olfactory neurons structured?
They're bipolar. A long dendrite branches into 520 cilia in the nasal cavity. Receptor proteins sit on these cilia membranes, binding to odor molecules. Each neuron is specialized.
And smell is unique because it goes straight to the cortex. No thalamus relay.
That's right. And no major crossover between nostrils and brain hemispheres.
How many receptors do we actually have?
It's complex to pin down. Humans have tens of millions of olfactory neurons, maybe 350 types of receptor proteins coded by about 636 genes, the largest gene group we have. But maybe half those genes are non-functional now, evolutionarily speaking. Mice have around 1,300 receptor types, way more discriminating power. Dogs, billions of cells. Bears, even better, maybe.
So huge individual differences in sensitivity, and the signals go to the olfactory bulb, but also directly to the amygdala for emotional responses.
Yes, that direct link to the emotion center likely explains why smells can trigger such strong, fast feelings, especially fear.
Insects like moths have great smell too.
Crucial for finding food, mates over distance, antennae are key there. Evolutionarily, early Homo sapiens might have had slightly better smell than other hominids.
But maybe relying on dogs has weakened ours over time.
It's possible. And generally, women tend to have a better sense of smell than men, maybe linked to food foraging or safety in the past, though lots of individual variation.
Smell signals travel via the first cranial nerve, the olfactory nerve, but there's also nerve zero, the terminal nerve.
Yes, discovered in 1913, often overlooked. It's likely linked to the human vomeronasal organ, Jacobson's organ, which detects pheromones in many animals.
Its function in humans is still a bit murky, though. Doesn't connect to the olfactory bulb.
Right. But small fibers go to the retina, linking to day-length cues for reproduction. And we have the genes for pheromone receptors, like mice do, suggesting a similar role for nerve zero, even if unconscious.
Animal studies show cutting it affects mating interest. Stimulating it causes sexual responses.
Yes. In hamsters, rays. In rays, nerve zero endings in the hypothalamus release GnRH, regulating sexual behavior. Even whales and dolphins who lost their smell still have nerve zero.
That study about women preferring the smell of shirts from men with different immune systems is fascinating, but birth control changes that preference.
It seems to. Suggests hormones and maybe artificial scents could disrupt natural mate selection cues.
What about aromatherapy? Using scents for therapy.
Plausible basis, smells can affect physiology and mood, but strong evidence for specific therapeutic effects beyond placebo still lacking.
And odorless tears. Women's tears lowering male arousal and testosterone. Suggests pheromones again.
It does suggest chemical signaling. Research on male tears is limited, though.
Practically speaking, odor nuisance is a big deal. Olfactometry is the science of measuring it.
Indeed. And the future. Direct olfactory cortex stimulation, maybe to restore or even enhance smell. Neurotech is pushing boundaries.
Okay, moving to taste. Closely linked to smell, uses similar chemical receptors.
Absolutely. And let's bust that myth about the tongue map.
Right. No specific zones for sweet, salty, sour, bitter. Plus, there's umami, the fifth taste, savory, meaty.
And salty and sour feel more maybe direct. While spiciness isn't a taste, it's pain.
So all taste buds react to all tastes, and there are probably more than five receptor types.
Seems likely. Blurry categories, lots of variations. Taste receptors interact with molecules dissolved in saliva.
Salty uses sodium ions directly. Sour uses hydrogen ions.
Basically, yes, affecting ion channels. Sweet, bitter, and umami bind to G protein-coupled receptors, triggering an internal signal cascade.
How many taste buds do we have?
Around 2,000 to 5,000. Each bud has maybe 50, 150 receptor cells, located mostly on the tongue papillae, but also palate, throat.
Some papillae are just for food handling, no buds. The receptor cells have short lives, 10 days.
Some do, yes. Constant regeneration. And huge individual differences genetically, like PTC bitter for two-thirds, tasteless for one-third due to one gene. About 25% are super tasters, extra sensitive to bitter, especially women, and even more so during pregnancy.
And taste perception changes with hunger, or adaptation to a taste.
Definitely. Hunger makes things taste better. Continuous sweetness becomes less noticeable.
What triggers the basic tastes? Sweetnesses, sugars, alcohols?
Organic molecules, yeah. Bitterness, too, often poisons. Saltiness from salt ions, sodium mostly. Sourness from hydrogen ions. Umami from amino acids like glutamate.
But smell is way more sensitive, right? 10,000 times.
Easily. And flavor relies heavily on smell reaching the nasal cavity internally as we eat.
Which is why food tastes bland with a cold or COVID or a dry mouth. Temperature and texture matter too.
And taste adaptation happens when receptors stop responding, like acid making water taste sweet afterwards.
Or miraculin making sour things taste sweet.
That's a fascinating one. And spicy food, capsaicin, that's a burning pain sensation measured on the Scoville scale.
Right, from mild peppers up to millions of SHU for pure capsaicin extract.
Phew. Okay, now on to hearing. A distant sense. Giving advance warning.
Sound waves are air pressure changes vibrating the eardrum faster than wind.
And the frequency of those changes is pitch. Higher frequency, higher pitch. Higher frequency also means shorter wavelength. Sound in air is about 343 meters.
So 343 hertz is a 1 meter wavelength. 10,000 hertz is about 3.4 centimeters. Human range is roughly 20 hertz to 15-20,000 hertz.
Around there, low frequencies need high amplitude. High frequencies mainly affect timbre. Highest piano note is C5, just over 4,000 hertz.
Animals hear much higher. Dogs, 65,000 hertz. Bats, dolphins, up to 200,000 hertz.
For echolocation, yeah. That's a 2 millimeter wavelength, great for finding tiny insects. Moths and grasshoppers hear up to 130 kilohertz to detect bats.
Sound in water is faster. 1,530 meters allows locating maybe 1 centimeter objects?
Potentially. So sound waves enter the outer ear, funnel through the canal, vibrate the eardrum.
Then the middle ear bones, malleus, and acoustic stapes transmit that vibration.
Via the oval window into the fluid-filled inner ear.
And the challenge is converting that acoustic stimulus into electrical signals, keeping the frequency, loudness, location info.
Exactly. Outer, middle, inner ear segments handle this. Those tiny middle ear bones, the ossicles, evolved. Interesting story there. Frogs and reptiles might only have the stapes.
The inner ear has the semicircular canals and vestibule for balance, and the cochlea for hearing.
Right. The cochlea is that spiral canal. Oval window vibrations create waves in the cochlear fluid.
Low frequencies travel further, reaching the more flexible part of the basilar membrane near the apex.
Correct. And sitting on that basilar membrane is the organ of Corti. About 3,500 inner hair cells, the primary receptors, tuned to different frequencies based on location.
Plus more numerous outer hair cells with cilia touching the tectorial membrane.
Yes. Vibration bends the cilia, opening closing ion channels. They're mechanoreceptors, converting movement to electrical signals for the cochlear nerve.
Loudness depends on how many hair cells are stimulated. Pitch depends on which cells along the basilar membrane.
Precisely. Each inner hair cell connects to about 10 neurons in the auditory nerve. That goes to the brainstem for quick analysis, then mostly crosses over to the opposite brain hemisphere.
And hearing evolved from reptilian jaw bones. You can see that in baby kangaroos.
It's an amazing evolutionary trace. Our hearing is also tuned most sensitively to speech frequencies, 500, 3,000 hertz, like old telephone bandwidth.
Animals use ear movements and timing differences between ears for localization. The brain calculates tiny arrival time differences.
Incredibly fast calculations. And we can also get sound info via bone vibrations.
Human hearing sensitivity is vast. Threshold is a billionth of atmospheric pressure change. Pain threshold, 10 trillion times greater, 130 dB.
Astounding range. And those 16, 20,000 hair cells let us distinguish maybe 1,500 pitches.
A piano has 88 notes from 27.5 hertz to over 4,000 hertz. And we can notice a 1 hertz difference around 1,000 hertz. That's precise.
Crucial for playing instruments like the violin accurately. Tiny finger movements needed.
Okay, balance and spatial orientation. We're constantly fighting gravity.
And our brain integrates info from multiple sources. The vestibular system in the inner ear.
Detecting head orientation and acceleration using hair cells in the labyrinth.
Yes. Plus, vision gives body position cues. Pressure receptors in the feet tell us about weight distribution, center of gravity, and proprioception informs about muscle tension.
Complex integration in the cortex and cerebellum determines muscle adjustments.
Absolutely. The link to vision is clear with the vestibulo-ocular reflex, the VOR. Stabilizes vision during head movement. Ernst Ewald studied this connection to nystagmus back in the day.
The vestibular system uses hair cells like hearing, but stimulated differently. Clever reuse of structures.
Exactly. The five receptor organs are the utricle, saccule, and three semicircular canals.
Utricle and saccule handle linear acceleration, gravity, head tilt, bend, cilia.
Right. The three semicircular canals are loops in three planes, monitoring linear and especially angular acceleration from head rotation.
Detecting acceleration means sensing inertia. Utricle and saccule are key for linear acceleration, gravity. They have otoliths.
Yes, tiny calcium carbonate crystals in a gelatinous layer over the hair cells. About 30,000 hair cells in the utricle, 16,000 in the saccule, present even in fish.
Otolith movement stimulates hair cells, sensing inertia, like pebbles in moving water, giving info on velocity changes.
Precisely. Acceleration, not constant velocity. The vestibular nerve gathers this position info.
Its projections explain dizziness, temporal cortex, motion sickness, autonomic areas in brainstem, conscious awareness of movement, somatosensory cortex.
Correct. And this system, with touch, vision, proprioception, helps create a map of peripersonal space, the area around us. Near space is represented differently from far space.
Disorders there can be really weird. Our overall space perception blends egocentric, self-centered, and allocentric, object-centered views. Allocentric develops around 3 to 5 years old.
Yes, as kids learn to take other perspectives. These mechanisms give us our sense of location, a result of neuronal processes.
The importance of movement and balance in some cultures is striking. Like the Anlo-Yu people in Ghana having 50 words for ways of moving. Sesalemi.
That concept of feel body inside really highlights how embodied perception can be, challenging Western mind-body dualism. We even judge character by how someone moves.
Okay, let's tackle vision. Diffuse light carries tons of information, but extracting it isn't easy.
Eyes convert light to electrochemical impulses. Even simple photoreceptors in microorganisms allow phototaxis sensing light intensity day-night.
Like marine organisms moving to different depths, or snails reacting to sudden shadows indicating movement.
Basic threat detection. The last common ancestor of animals probably had something similar.
The key is photopigments transforming light energy. Retinal changing shape when a photon hits.
Cis to transform. Triggers a complex protein cascade very fast, closing sodium channels, changing the electrical state. More complex than mechanoreceptors.
These photoreceptive cells are in the retina at the back of the eye.
Containing rhodopsin in rods for dim light, high sensitivity, and related opsins in cones, less sensitive for color.
Three cone types in humans, S for blue, M for green, L for red. Rods absorb near M cones. Overlapping spectra.
That's the basis of trichromatic color vision, proposed by Young and Helmholtz. The RGB model. Simultaneous activity lets us see millions of colors, common in primates.
Many other animals are dichromatic, two cone types.
Yes, it's a reminder of how differently animals see. But light has to pass through other retinal layers first, before hitting rods and cones.
Right, there's initial processing in these local circuits. They have tonic activity inhibited in darkness. Light hyperpolarizes the photoreceptors, disinhibiting bipolar cells. A whole network fires up before the signal leaves via the optic nerve.
The human retina structure is a bit backward. Rods and cones at the very back. Light passes through ganglion cells, amacrine cells, bipolar cells first.
And the optic nerve exit creates the blind spot.
This processing creates receptive fields in the ganglion cells on center off center. Enhances contrast, edges, shapes.
So the internal representation isn't like a photo. It's signals from a million receptive fields sent via maybe a dozen video paths for the brain to reconstruct.
Exactly. Even a simple light flash activates all 12 ganglion cell types in that spot.
We have about 6 million cones, 100 million rods, but only a million fibers in the optic nerve. Lots of convergence and processing in the retina itself.
Primitive organisms might lack focusing optics. But mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians have complex optics. Cornea, lens focusing light, iris controlling pupil size.
Image-forming eyes evolved multiple times. Mollusks, chordates, arthropods, 10 different forms.
Remarkable convergent evolution. Cornea and lens refract light onto the retina. Aqueous humor fills the space. Iris acts like a diaphragm.
Trilobites had unique calcite lenses. The ancient parietal third eye is now vestigial.
Yes, in some reptiles, amphibians, fish. Functions unclear, maybe circadian rhythms, thermoregulation, vitamin D.
Arthropods have compound eyes, multiple omentidia, each with a lens, giving a pixelated view or multiple images.
Can be very sensitive to movement, offer 360-degree view. Some, like Strepsiptera, have few facets, but each forms an image the brain combines for higher resolution.
Cephalopods, fish, amphibians, snakes, focus by moving the lens, like a camera.
Yes, and octopus eyes are arguably better designed than our photoreceptors at the front. No blind spot, different focusing, no myopia, hyperopia.
Compound eyes can see shapes and colors, too. Binocular vision helps predators with depth perception. Prey animals often maximize field of view.
Classic trade-off. Jumping spiders have main eyes for detail, smaller ones for periphery. Sorry. Caterpillars have stomata for rough images. Snails might just have ocelli distinguishing light dark.
So many ways to see. Vision has to solve conflicting needs. Seeing in dark and bright light.
Iris control, different receptors. Seeing sharp and wide.
Eye movements, reacting fast and analyzing accurately.
Different transmission pathways. Seeing all around and perceiving depth.
Multiple eyes or independent movement. Seeing constant color under different lighting.
Cortical processing. Seeing near and far for action and planning.
Are we using all the info in light? No. Limited spectrum, poor polarization perception.
Which is key for navigation in insects, crustaceans, cephalopods. Bee dance depends on it. Humans can learn weak polarization perception, apparently.
Mantis shrimp vision is wild. 360 degrees, independent eyes, circular polarization, 12-16 cones, 4 UV, near IR. But maybe less subtle color discrimination.
Possibly saving energy on fine color analysis for faster decisions. That's Thone et al.'s idea.
Nocturnal birds like owls have huge eyes, overlapping fields, lots of rods, no cones. Oil birds use echolocation in caves.
Shows that good vision is information heavy, needs brain power. Echolocation is better in dark or water. Evolution optimizes for the niche. Two processing heavy senses might be too costly.
Like vipers with poor distance vision relying on stereo smell and infrared heat sensing.
Exactly. Day snakes might have yellow eyes as UV filters. Night snakes show some UV sensitivity.
Comparing eye sensitivity to cameras, human eye is like ISO 1 in daylight, maybe 500 separate eons at night. Weaker than cameras.
Generally, yes. Seeing auras isn't super sensitive eyes. It's likely processing errors or interpretations on the way to conscious perception areas.
In the dark, peripheral vision, rods, works better. Like seeing noise patterns in high ISO photos.
Good analogy. In low light, the visual cortex gets weak input from the retina, but stronger top-down input from memory expectation areas. That can create perceptions of shapes, faces that aren't their ghosts.
Why don't we see upside down? Prism glasses show the brain adapts, but the question itself assumes a homunculus.
Right. In the brain, it's all electrical patterns, no up or down. Input from any sense touch, hearing electrodes can be analyzed if it carries useful information. That's the basis of sensory substitution. The world representation is just relationships needed for action.
Okay, let's get into interoception senses about our body's internal state.
And recent work shows we vary in how well we can verbalize different senses. Majid et al. Found English speakers go smell, touch, taste, hearing, shape, color, from hardest to easiest to describe. But this varies hugely by culture. Smell might be best encoded elsewhere.
Beyond the main senses, many other receptors inform us about body state, often chemical receptors, ligands affecting ion channels.
Like thirst. That's an internal sense. Osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus signal the brain.
Physiology of thirst. Body is mostly water. Homeostasis is key. Dehydration is dangerous. So osmoreceptors in the OVLT nucleus and subfornical organ measure osmotic pressure changes from water loss.
Dry mouth happens as salivary glands draw water from blood. ADH hormone is released, telling kidneys to reabsorb water and sodium.
But there's a faster mechanism, too. Wetting the mouth and throat gives temporary relief, while slower mechanisms act. Plus, stomach receptors.
Exactly. And if these receptor signals fail or interpretation fails, we might not notice critical body states.
Like from brain damage or just being too absorbed in something. The gamer who died after 73 hours.
Tragic example of ignoring internal cues. Hunger is another vital internal sense. We're homeothermic, need temperature regulation. All depends on metabolism providing ATP energy.
The ATP-ADP cycle. Daily ATP turnover equals our body mass, shows the high metabolic rate. Some animals eat more than their weight daily.
Glycemic index affects blood glucose and hunger. Insulin regulates it. Body mass is usually pretty stable, though.
Carl Lashley suspected hunger wasn't just an empty stomach back in the 30s, showed the hypothalamus was key.
Lateral hypothalamus for hunger, ventromedial for satiety. It responds to hormones like leptin.
From fat cells, signaling energy reserves, and ghrelin from the stomach and ARC nucleus.
Right. Leptin informs the hypothalamus. Low leptin increases NPY and AGRP, causing hunger. NPY triggers ghrelin fast. AGRP acts slower, causing longer overeating and reps.
Nutrient deficiencies also drive appetite and cravings, and chewing, swallowing influence satiety.
All play a role. Disruptions lead to eating disorders like anorexia, bulimia, or pica craving non-edibles, often in pregnancy, complex links to mental health.
Then there's the enteric nervous system, ENS, in the gut, the second brain.
Hundreds of millions of neurons. Controls gut-brain interactions beyond digestion, influences emotions, stress, disgust, fatigue, gut feelings, linked to immune system, endocrine system, the brain-gut microbiome axis.
ENS dysfunction causes gut diseases, but may be also linked to mental disorders. Anxiety, depression, autism often correlate with gut issues.
Growing evidence for that bidirectional link. And finally, perception of time. Unique, complex, not fully understood.
Brain assesses neuronal states. Perceives changes in biological rhythms. Different timescales involve different structures. Influenced by emotion, interoception.
Yes. For seconds, minutes, posterior insular cortex activity seems linked to time passing. We need to distinguish physical time, clocks, neuronal time, integration windows, and psychological time, subjective feel.
Our present window is few seconds. Integrating past traces and future predictions.
Something like that. Regular rhythms like circadian cycles feel different from rapid changes. Circadian rhythm is regulated by the SCN in the hypothalamus, influenced by light, temperature, hormones. Chronobiology studies this.
Repeated stimuli habituate, seem shorter. New stimuli take more processing, seem longer. And in dark caves, our rhythm lengthens.
About an hour longer, yes. Fascinating stuff.
Now, sensory substitution. Using one sense to get info normally from another.
Mainly for impairments, but also for novel experiences, expanding abilities. The cortex is specialized but structurally similar six layers, columns, suggests function is largely determined by input channel from the thalamus.
Experiments support this. Transplanting auditory cortex in rats, it became visual-like. Rewiring ferret brains, auditory cortex processed vision.
Remarkable plasticity. For vision substitution, early attempts like Nozewski's electrophotom converted light to sound, then tactile versions with vibrators on the forehead.
Echolocation for the blind, tongue, clicks, cane taps. World Access for the Blind teaches this. Some can even cycle.
Aids use sonification from cameras, ultrasounding canes converted to sound or vibration or tongue stimulation, ultrasound glasses too.
Blind infants using devices early learn to orient, reach, search for toys. Apps like VIs convert images to soundscapes. iMusic codes color to timbre.
With training, people develop interpretation skills, often with a visual feel, especially if they had sight before.
Brainport vision uses electrodes on the tongue, requires training. Similar devices use vibration on the back or forehead.
Yes, like the forehead retina system. And imaging shows visual cortex V1 activity in blind users of these devices, increasing with proficiency. The brain repurposes areas.
Direct optic nerve stimulation is ideal but hard. Artificial retinas exist but are costly, need rehab.
That's the current state. But touch alone allows orientation and object recognition. Think military tactile symbols, Braille.
Moon type is easier for those who lost sight. Braille reading speed can match visual reading. Touch is a fast channel.
Paul Bacchiarita's 60s experiments with the vibrating chairs showed people learned faster with active pointing. Perception isn't passive. Sensations felt out there, not on the screen. All use vibration. These vests can also give environmental awareness, interesting for military use. FeelSpace NASA belt uses vibration for magnetic north detection.
Improving orientation, kinesthetic memory. Rats with compass signals to visual cortex navigated mazes, better blindfolded.
Yes. Vibration feedback helps prosthetic rehab, balance disorders too, even tongue vibrators work. Brain learns to use natural vibrations. Patients don't need constant stimulation later.
Potential for controlling drones, device alerts for pilots. FlyViz gives 360 view in AR glasses. FeelSpace waist belts for North. Navier uses bone conduction.
Lots of innovation. Initially, new sensory input feels chaotic. How do new qualia, subjective sensations, emerge? Eagleman suggests the brain learns patterns, compares, adds context, interaction leads to sensation. Entirely new qualia seem possible.
The brain integrates useful new signals. Subjective feel depends on signal structure, retinal versus tactile. We describe by comparison. Active sensing modifies sensations, sensor motor theory.
Which connects to cyborgization, biohacking interest. Perceiving magnetic fields via vibration gives a new magnetic sense. Biohackers implant magnets.
Similar for electric fields. Infrared detection. Rats learned IR camera input to visual cortex in a day, extending hearing to infrasound ultrasound.
I'll provide new info. We don't see UV because the cornea filters it. Artificial biocorneas might allow seeing new shades.
These devices can feel surprisingly natural. Orientation resembles visual experience. New senses give indescribable sensations linked to emotion memory.
Yes. Caution is needed with things like e-drugs might negatively impact brain connections. Vibration therapies like sound yoga, BWV exist. Maybe some real effects like serotonin increase from rhythmic movement despite pseudoscience framing.
So we perceive our brain's reactions, not the world directly. Culture shapes sense use. We've covered receptors, signals reaching the brain. Next is cortical processing.
Exactly. And a final fun fact, the Mormon Transhumanist Society is one of the larger transhumanist groups globally. Unexpected, right? A 2018 talk on this is worth checking out too.
Okay, a challenge for you, our listener. Reflect on how your senses cooperate to create reality. How do smell and taste blend for flavor? Which memories are most vivid sensorily? Which senses does imagination trigger most? How does context change perception? What functions go unnoticed until impaired?
And think about those review questions we touched on. Types of receptors, the senses, touch details, taste buds, smell receptors, nerve zero, balance mechanisms, thirst, hunger, the ENS, sensory substitution examples, eye diversity, where we don't see upside down, illusions in the dark. Plenty to mull over.
For deeper dives, check out those Planet Plus HD programs, National Geographic's Mind Traps, BBC Earth's Pendulap episode, and the recommended readings Cerebrum, various books and articles covering plant communication, neurobiology, consciousness, gut feelings, specific senses, visual evolution. Lots there.
And the main source for today was Vuutsisa Dutch's Introduction to Cognitive Science, Chapter A13 on Sensory Receptors from UMK Taru 2025.
So to quickly recap this packed deep dive, we explored why we have senses, how touch, smell, taste, hearing, balance, and vision work in amazing detail, peeked into interoception, and looked at the future with sensory substitution.
Yeah, and for me, the aha moment is always the brain's sheer adaptability. Remapping sensory input, the potential for new senses, it's incredible plasticity.
And for you, our listener, we hope this deep dive was a valuable shortcut, getting you well-informed quickly about how you experience everything around you.
So the final thought. If our brains are this adaptable, capable of creating new senses, what does that really say about the limits of our perception? Are there any limits? Or are we just sensing a tiny fraction of what's possible?